Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shibley Tilhami, who is the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He has served as an advisor to the United States mission to the United Nations and most recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. His best-selling book, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, was selected by Foreign Affairs as one of the top five books on the Middle East, and he's the co-author of Liberty and Power, A Dialogue on Religion and U.S. Foreign Policy in an Unjust World. And his latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shibley Tilhami.
My pleasure.
And in the introduction to the program, which you didn't hear, Shibley, I said that in terms of this segment, I said we will discuss Syria as the third and most recent Arab country to face civil war after enduring decades of dictatorship, with Iraq and Libya in chaos after being liberated by U.S. and NATO military force. We'll look at the prospects for avoiding the destruction and division of Syria, which is caught in both a regional proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran and a wider context between the U.S. and Russia, both of whom do not want al-Qaeda to take over Syria. So good news and bad news. Start with the bad news.
I think when you look at the situation in Syria is it's very hard in any foreseeable future to see an outcome that is stable or that is good for its neighbors and its people. It's very hard, and that's really the bad news. I think it's look at what has transpired over the last couple of years. What started as primarily an uprising against an authoritarian regime really has become so complicated, not only because of the sectarianism that is at the core of Syrian society, but also because of the intervention of so many international players who have a stake in the outcome. And it's become multi-layered, very difficult to separate. It's very hard for the U.S. To do something in Syria without thinking about how the Turks are going to react, or how the Russians are going to react, or how the Iranians are going to react, or how Hezbollah is going to react. So all of that is really making it far more difficult for anybody to contemplate a real solution.
Well, it's pretty clear that President Obama is not George W. Bush or Dick Cheney, that he seems to be cautious and thoughtful about these things. But when you start with the statements from the French foreign minister and then the French president, the British foreign secretary, and then the prime minister, and then you have Chuck Hagel, and now you have the vice president weighing in, and I presume perhaps on Thursday after Martin Luther King's 50th anniversary celebration, the president may say something or even do something. In all of this, is there any voices out there that are at least counseling caution?
Well, I think the train has already left the station. I really do. I think if there was any doubt about that, I think the statement by Secretary Kerry yesterday made it very clear. And so I think a decision has been made to do something, because the way they stated the facts in terms of not only the massacre itself or the using chemical weapons, but directly blaming Assad for doing it, it's making it impossible for them to go back. So the real question is what it is that they're going to do, and who will be partnering with the U.S. Now, obviously, this isn't going to be something that the U.N. is going to support. Russia clearly will not support this, and neither will China. So can you have a coalition, first of all, of perhaps NATO plus some Arab states, and what sort of action it will be, and what is the aim? So I think we're all watching not to see whether there will be action. I think it's a foregone conclusion. I think only the Syrian foreign minister, who just issued a statement saying he's still unconvinced that military action will take place, I think he's the only one who is unconvinced. I think it's pretty foregone conclusions, just a question of what shape and form it will take.
But as I mentioned in the opening introduction, this is the third Arab country to be involved in a civil war and perhaps have foreign military forces intervene, as happened in Iraq and then in Libya. And the results in both the case of Iraq and Libya are pretty sad. They certainly got rid of a dictator. Is that a part of the problem here, that these dictatorships that last for decades, they just simply ruined countries? I mean, what's your sense of the prospects of building a country anew if somehow or other the Assad family disappears?
Well, I think obviously what dictators do is make sure that they are the state, and therefore, they in a way demolish a possibility that you can have a state without them. And people start equating the state with the dictator and the threat to the dictator, the threat to the state. The extreme version of that was, of course, Gaddafi, who actually, in a way, abolished many of the institutions of the state to create this direct rule. So, yes, it's in part how some dictators govern, which make it very difficult for alternatives. But in part, it's also how the transition is handled and who's doing it. And I think, frankly, foreign intervention in the Middle East has not worked. If you look at that over the decades, it's the British experience, the French experience, the American experience, is tremendous resistance. Even those people who, on the face of it, seem to want help will not thank you if you seem to be even intervening on humanitarian grounds, because there is so much suspicion of the intention of the West. And we see that dating back to, the inception of the modern political system after World War I. So the U.S. hasn't had a very successful record, frankly, in managing it. And in the Iraq case, it is clear that one of the big mistakes that were made was destroying the two significant institutions that could have helped build a stable country, that is the military and the Ba'ath Party. In retrospect, that was something that was seen as a mistake in helping bring it about. In Syria, obviously the civil war is not mostly due to direct foreign intervention. It happened on its own, and the intervention is complicating it. Even though it's at a small scale, I suspect that whatever the U.S. is going to do, it's going to be even more complicated because it may be something U.S. has to do in part because of the humanitarian disaster, but it is unlikely to make the peaceful outcome closer the next morning.
Now, but if would this be happening, Shibli Talhami, had President Obama not drawn the red line, or is this happening because the of the red line over the use of WMD? I mean, in other words, how much do you think the president is trapped by his own rhetoric, or how much is he obliged to act because of this idea that a weapon of mass destruction is being used against civilians?
It's a really good question. And obviously, there are a lot of people are saying, don't draw these superficial lines and keep your options open. There's something to be said for that. But let's be realistic here. Number one, public opinion in the U.S. isn't pushing the president to act. Remember that.
No, 9%. Only 9% of the American people support military action in Syria.
And even when people are convinced that Assad actually used chemical weapons on large scale, you only get about 25% support. So there is no public pressure on him. So what is the red line for whom? The credibility may be in the international community, but ultimately when you act and you pay a price, I'm not sure that the price you pay is lesser than the seeming cost to your reputation here. So I don't really know, where this idea comes that the red line, therefore, he's obligated to follow, particularly when there is no public pressure. Second, I think that, obviously they had made the decision before the UN concluded its investigation. Now, they may have concluded, you know, that it's a useless investigation, fine, but they didn't even try to use it as a fig leaf. So, you know, perhaps they've concluded for themselves with some degree of certainty that, you know, Assad did use it. But they could have, if they really wanted to get out of it, used this fig leaf and work with it, or waited to see what happened, and then put the Russians on the defensive or somebody else on the defensive and see how the rest of the world would act. So the decision, in my own view, was done, it could not have been simply because of the chemical weapons. I think they may have been a strategic decision. They had to weigh all sorts of things, including the fact that even to enter the negotiations in Geneva, Assad seemed to have the upper hand, and there was no element there weakening him. They may have thought that this element would give an opportunity to weaken him, to make it more possible for a negotiation. It is also possible the president feels he needs to look tough a little bit. He hasn't done that of late, and he's facing some additional challenges down the road, perhaps with regard to Iran, something he really doesn't want to do. So it's hard to, I wouldn't just pin it all on the chemical weapons. I think it's certainly chemical weapons deserve response if they were used, and I think that's a separate issue, obviously morally. But policy-wise, I suspect there was a strategic element as well in the picture.
And again, I'm speaking with Shibli Talhami, who's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the U.S. mission, to the UN, and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. His latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. So if there is a new strategic calculus, then if there was a policy prior to this, and as I've mentioned in the previous interview, that there's an asymmetry between the commitments that the Iranians and Hezbollah and Russia have to support the Assads and the ambivalence that the West and America has about who it is they're supporting on the rebel side, and they haven't really furnished any significant amounts of arms. So a lot of cynics were suggesting that that's the policy, to have both sides exhaust, to you know, to draw Iran in, and it's costing Iran a lot financially, and it's cost Hezbollah a lot in terms of its credibility, and that they were just going to wait for both sides to, you know, duke it out and get exhausted. You're suggesting that something else may have changed. Is the former scenario plausible to you?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think, you know, I'm sure there are people who might see some utility in that, but and I've seen, obviously, the public discourse on this. I don't think so. I think what happened with the administration is it started off, you know, swept in its thinking by the Arab uprisings, particularly in Tunisia and Egypt. They were peaceful. They were successful. It looked like history is going in one direction. Libya came along, and then ultimately ended with Syria, and they have taken their, you know, they had taken sides. You know, as you can see, the administration took a position very quickly that Assad must go before they even had contemplated what the consequences of that statement is. But they took a position very simply against Assad, and I think two things happened. One is, it turned out it wasn't that simple. It wasn't happening on its own. And number two, when they supported the coalition, they were wholeheartedly behind the idea of supporting the opposition against Assad, until they discovered that the al-Qaeda groups were the ones who were doing much of the fighting, and they stood to gain. And the fear of repetition of Afghanistan and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan really crept in, and the administration applied the brakes, and it paralyzed its ability to maneuver, and it became reactive in its policy. And when you're reactive, you allow everyone else to dictate your policy, what you do, because people know your weaknesses and your strengths, and they push the right button. And so I think that's where they are. I think the policy is needs to be revisited. I think this is obviously an opportunity for them to rethink. They're going to have to rethink no matter what, because once you engage in military action, the next morning the world changes. The world today will look different after this action, because, you know, wars sweep the rug from under you, and they always have, and even limited wars have unanticipated consequences. So they'll wake up to a different world the next morning. They'll wake up to a different relationship with Syria, and they're going to have to reassess. They don't know what it's going to look like, because that's the case with wars.
Well, assuming they take out the airport and stop the supply from aerial supply coming in over Iraq, which the U.S. has tried to get the Iraqis to stop, from Iran, stop, you know, damage the port of Latakia or whatever to stop the Russians continuing the supply, and then take out every castle, every place that every home. I mean, this is the private plantation of the Assad family, the country of Syria. So there's a whole bunch of opulent palaces, that et cetera. At the end of the day, aren't you going to be, in effect, in a more likely position that more chemical weapons are going to be used if you weaken them sufficiently?
Personally, I think that the use of the chemical weapons, besides being immoral, is strategically stupid for Assad. And I suspect that I'm still scratching my head. I mean, I assume the administration has evidence, because it's very hard to see what sort of incentive they do, particularly when they have the overwhelming capacity to choke the opposition and destroy them with overwhelming military hardware. So why would they need these chemical weapons to kill 200-400 people, and then get all of the anger of the international community, put themselves on the wrong side, and so forth? It doesn't, it makes you scratch your head. I mean, this doesn't make sense, separate from the immorality of it. And that's why I think, I'm still trying to figure out for what reason would they use them. And I think one of the possible explanations is what the Israelis, one Israeli, at least, was quoted in the New York Times as saying that something maybe went operationally wrong, that perhaps they were trying to use them on a limited scale to scare the opposition, and it went out of control, and they end up killing a lot of people. So right. I don't really see the chemical weapons use as helping them strategically, except in an all-out war when they know they're going to be destroyed.
Well, that's what I was suggesting. That's maybe the next stage. And I thank you for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Shibli Talhami, who's the Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and Senior Fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. He served as an advisor to the U.S. mission to the UN and more recently served on the Iraq Study Group as a member of the Strategic Environment Working Group. His latest book is The World Through Arab Eyes. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into alternatives to military force in Syria.
اكتب واخط بالقلم اكتب واخط بالقلم دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي يواسيني